God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. You have the ability to unmute. Feel free to do that and say hello. First 30 days, anybody? All righty then. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Brian D. from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or as my father would call it, Pennsyltucky. he's going to come tell his story. And after that, we'll take a short break somewhere around the top of the hour. We'll pass the seven tradition basket, call for announcements, et cetera. And then we'll take the questions that you submit and we'll reconvene and then interview Brian. So super excited. Brian came in at the last minute. We had a cancellation and he was recommended and I called him and he said, sure. And I don't want to take up another minute of his time. I give you Brian.
Thanks, Dave. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brian, and it's good to be here sober tonight. My sobriety date is June 27th of 1984. I am a member of the There's More to Life group, which is in New Cumberland, Pennsylvania. Think Harrisburg. And I have a sponsor. I sponsor a lot of people. They sponsor people, you know, and so on. And I've had that really that life transforming experience that Alcoholics Anonymous offers to alcoholics through the practice of the 12 steps and what we call in a shorthand, a spiritual awakening. And so what I'll try to do tonight to the best of my ability is to try to follow some of the standards that are laid out in the big book to talk about what we were like, what happened, what we're like now. And and there's a portion of the big book when it's describing the stories in the back, and it highlights that the point of the stories or the center of those stories is how people develop a relationship with a power greater than themselves sufficient to relieve them of their alcoholism. And so I will try to talk about that. I can tell you in advance, I will fail like at almost all levels, but we'll see how close I can come. I also should say I'm always a jacket and tie guy when I speak, and so I'm a little out of uniform tonight. I'm away. I'm on vacation, and so I don't have a jacket and tie with me. So you get the no tie look. I tend to start all over the place. This place I'll start is as good as any other. When I got sober in Pittsburgh, and actually I learned there was another Pittsburgh native on the call with us tonight, and that's where I was born and got sober there. And I spent the first year there, then I moved away for a mix of school, work, and I moved back to Pittsburgh right at about my fifth anniversary. And I had the chance to return to my very first home group and to go to the meetings where I had gotten sober. And I was very excited. I knew this would be a real treat, for them, to have sort of star pupil returns. So I go to the meeting, and this woman named Helen, who was actually at my first meeting and at meetings with me regularly through the first year, she came up to me and she said, "It is so good to see you." And a part of me thought, yeah, I know. That's why. And and then she said, "We never thought you'd get sober." And I thought, why? And then she said, you were so angry. And I was. And the funny thing is, I don't think until she said that, I don't think I really understood that other people could see that. I thought I had the successful alcoholic thing of, I get out of the car where I'm ready to kill somebody. I walk up, and just before I hit the door, I reach in the bag, I pull out the AA mask, I click that on, walk into the room, and now I'm super Mr. Sober, and that's exactly what you guys think. And I'm, you know, telling you, oh yeah, really glad to be here, really glad to be here. And that I had everybody fooled. And I don't know why I thought that would be true about me, because it's never been true about anybody else I've met in AA. But I guess each of us has that experience. We think it's true about ourselves and nobody else. So if there are folks here though, who are new tonight and you're in that space where you think you have to hide something or that you're successfully hiding it, the two great truths in AA are you don't have to hide it and you're not doing it successfully anyway. And so, so you're welcome and come in the door for us. But part of what happened is, you know, as I look back on that, so my God willing, I'll celebrate my 37th anniversary at the end of this month. When I walked in the door, people never thought I'd make it. And that is not a testament to me. That's a testament to what Alcoholics Anonymous could do. Maybe the drinking part or the pre-drinking part even, come from a large family. There's lots of alcoholism. My immediate family's not that big, but like sort of the extended family. If we could get along, we could have our own country. My grandmother was the youngest of 16. And when I was at my great aunt's funeral, the priest happened to mention how happy she would be because all 42 of her grandchildren were there. And so it's that kind of family. Unfortunately, lots of great things about it. Unfortunately, one of the things about it is that alcoholism runs through our family. You cannot swing a dead cat without hitting an alcoholic. I was around that my whole life. And you would think there would have been a part of me that would have said, oh, stay away from that. I was fascinated by it. The people in my family who really seemed to have fun were the drinkers. And I was drawn to them. I never saw an actual person use a shot glass until I was an adult. Because everybody drank whiskey out of water glasses. And that just seemed totally normal and exciting. And I always remember my uncle, he would ask my mother for a drink and she would pour the whiskey in and then she would start to pour water on top of it. And he would say nothing as the whiskey was going in. And then as the water was coming in, he'd be like, whoa, that's enough. And it was just that it meant something to me. And so, but I didn't drink actually, very much at all. Until I got to college, probably for a variety of reasons. But when I got to college, I actually went to the same college as Dr. Bob. And so, a longstanding history of unsuccessful drinking. I had always been, like, I'd loved school, always been a good student, really enjoyed it. I still do. I really loved learning all those kinds of things. And somehow when I got there, I was suddenly placed among a whole bunch of other people who were exactly the same, who had always loved learning, always good students, always smart. And unlike me, most of them, or at least it seemed to be all of them, but that was almost undoubtedly not true. But most of them had what my family always talked about, but never had, which was money. And we had all kinds of shame about not having money and fear and all this sort of stuff. And so somehow it felt like failure and it felt exposed. And those feelings, which I associated with the fact that we didn't have money, had nothing to do with the fact that we didn't have money. It had to do with the fact that I was spiritually ill and my spiritual illness had focused on that. Then alcohol came along. And, I went from someone who had never really drank at all. I mean, like other than sampling alcohol, to a really probably within 2 months, people were betting that I couldn't go a week without drinking because of the, just the way I drank and I, you know, I had that gift that turned out, it turned out to be a gift for me. It didn't feel like it necessarily at the time, but I had a very rapid progression. And, you know, when I started drinking, basically it was like brakes are off and you're just, you know, you're sort of, you're in free fall. And probably within 3 or 4 months, I was a daily drunk. I mean, it just, it was, and then drugs got thrown on top of that. And so if I was in third gear with the, just the alcohol, drugs put me in perhaps sixth gear on a 5-gear car. So, and I was just heading downhill and, I couldn't function. So I went from someone who was really, really good at a lot of things, to someone who couldn't do anything. And the worst part about it was in some ways that I couldn't do anything, but in my head, I could rework it that the fact that I couldn't do it was okay. That it was, I either didn't want it or it was somebody else's fault. You know, one of the things I came to understand about alcoholism is that idea that, that you know, while non-alcoholics may change their behavior to meet their goals, alcoholics change their goals to meet their behavior. And so if I couldn't drink and get something, I no longer wanted it. And then this became enough. And when I couldn't have that anymore, then that became enough. And it's, and that is not something that ends when we drink. If untreated, that will dominate our sobriety as well. Or our dryness, and it's just chip, 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 and our, as our life gets chipped away, and every gift we're given, we can't take. And that's what was happening to me. And so so we live these diminished lives, drunk, and we can do the same thing sober. And I've done that at various points. I was no surprise when you drink all night and sleep all day. It turns out that college is actually built for people who are present all day and sleep all night. And so it was, I was not thriving. And I had come to the attention of the it's called the Dean of Students. So think of there, people talk about being on the Dean's list. There's the academic Dean's list. You're knocking it out of the park. There's the behavioral dean of students, you're a troublemaker. I was on the dean of students behavioral troublemaker dean's list. The other guy didn't know me at all. And lots of stuff was happening. And what ended up happening was a friend of mine went to the dean and said that that she was really worried about me. She said she thought I was drinking myself to death. And so the dean called me to his office, and as I look back on it, the conversation was, you know, your friend did this, my friend was there, and blah blah blah, and what he said, and I know this is what he said, was, I have made an appointment for you this afternoon with a drug and alcohol counselor, if you want to go. Now, that is what he actually said. What I heard was, Brian, can you do a favor for me? There's this drug and alcohol counselor. Can you go see her? And I will owe you one. You know, alcoholics have a lot of trouble operating in what is actually real. And I was deep in that. So I went to see, you know, as a favor to him. So he would owe me one. I went to see the drug and alcohol counselor. And of course, I learned something really important about counseling. I showed up unless I couldn't show up. I didn't tell the truth. And I went under the influence. And I said, you know, this counseling doesn't work. And so, you know, I mean, and there's those lines in the Big Book that talk about no wonder medical professionals have such a low opinion of alcoholics. It's hardly surprising when the thing shows, it requires that you show up and be honest and participate. And I can not show up, not be honest, not participate. It's hardly a surprise that it didn't work. It's sort of like you know, people do in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. We come, we pick up our first chip, we don't do any of the work, and then we wonder why it failed. And that's why it failed. It's sort of like joining a gym, not going, and saying I can't figure out why I'm not more fit. The answer is because we didn't do anything. And so, so I went on my merry way, and I got in more trouble. And I knew I was going to be expelled. And for the first time, I thought, I think this has something to do with my drinking. Because when I went to the drug and alcohol concert, I didn't really think I had a drinking problem. I really thought I was surrounded by people who were reacting, overreacting to me. And that if I had money, they wouldn't do this. But they're just picking on me. And so so I went back to the dean and I said, you know, I think there's something wrong with me. I think I'm in all this trouble. And I think I actually think it has something to do with drinking. And we made a deal this time, actually. He said he would get me out of I went, of course, on the very last possible moment I could go prior to getting expelled. And he said he would get me out of the trouble I was in, break all the school rules, get me out of the trouble, in exchange for which I had to go to a rehab. I had never heard, to the best of my recollection, I'd never heard of a drug and alcohol rehab center. I certainly didn't have any idea what he was talking about at the time, but I agreed immediately. Because, see, when I'm in trouble, I'll say yes to anything that gets me out of the trouble. So that was on a Friday, and I remember that very distinctly, because that my mission was to go get into rehab. So Saturday comes, and I'm thinking rehab. Sunday, now it's starting to be like the Amy Winehouse song, you know, of, so you want to go to rehab, and I say, no, you know, I'm kind of getting there. By Monday, I'm back in the saddle. I can't even figure out why we were talking about rehab. I'm not in trouble. My drink has not gotten me anywhere. And the dean says to me, you know, like a couple of days later, hey, how's the rehab thing going? I'm like, oh, you know, couldn't go, like insurance. I never even called a rehab. I didn't do anything. But I lied and said I had some insurance problem, and which he tried to solve and couldn't solve. He tried to solve the imaginary problem for me. 2 weeks later, I was living in a second story room, and there were two windows in the corner room, and there were two windows. One window led to a sun deck, and we would like climb out and drink on the sun deck during the day. But to get there, you would sort of climb headfirst out the window onto the sun deck, which is the way it worked. So one window led to a sun deck, and one window did not. And in a blackout, I crawled through the wrong window. And so I fell two stories headfirst down into a concrete window well. And I fractured my skull. I did all kinds of other damage. And I was not expected to live. And then when it became clear I would live, I was expected that I would be so substantially damaged, I would never walk again. I wouldn't be able to talk. I mean, kinds of things that happen to people who have very traumatic brain injuries. It's somehow almost not surprising that the emergency room nurse who greeted me when I came in, I don't remember any of this, I was in a blackout, but the emergency room nurse who took me in was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met her a few years later. And I was unconscious for about a week. When I came to, I was, my dean friend was visiting with me in the hospital. There was no negotiation anymore. It turned out, which I didn't know at the time, it turned out that the college had hired a new drug and alcohol person. And that guy had said, whoever the next student is who comes up on the wheel with drug and alcohol problems, we're going to make him or her go to AA, and we're going to try that. And I happen to be that student. So they said, if you ever want to come back here, you're going to AA, among other things. We talk on AA a lot about bottoms and how important it is to hit a bottom. And that's absolutely true. I made the mistake at first, I think, of thinking of a bottom as an external event, that it was something that happened, that it was, you got arrested, you blah, 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 you got divorced, you lost a job, any of those kinds of things, that was a bottom. But actually, that's not it at all, I think, is that a bottom is really about how we relate to those external events. They can be all different. But when we get to that place where the last thing we lost or the next thing we're about to lose, and we can see it, you know, there's that moment of grace where it's enough of a spark that we're willing to do something different, to either get it back or not lose it. And that's different for everyone. And you know, far too many of us die before we get there. But for me, this was it. And they said, if you ever want to come back, you have to go to AA. So I went to AA. I didn't know anything at all about it. Honestly, I didn't. I'd never heard the phrase 12-step program. I'm positive I didn't know that. I did not know that you did not drink in it. So, by the way, if you're new and you didn't know that, surprise and welcome. But I really didn't know that. And I'll never forget it. I went to my very first meeting. I was late. It was a church I'd never been in before, and I go downstairs and I know what's going to be there, right? I know everybody knows what alcoholics look like. They're all men. They all have long coats and they're unshaven. And they don't live in homes. They live under bridges. And you know, I got sober in Pittsburgh. There are like 216 bridges, plenty of places to live. It wasn't quite clear to me how I hadn't worked out how they were getting from the bridge to where I was in the church. That was just a detail. And so, but I walk in, so I sit down in this room in my first meeting and I'm late. I come in, I rush in, I sit down in the back and then I look around the room and there are no alcoholics there. It is all these people who look like you. And this woman is talking about God. And I thought, oh, I'm in some kind of church meeting. So now I just like, I have to let her finish so I can slide back out the door and find the right room where the alcoholics are. She finishes, next person starts, it's Helen, the woman I was talking about earlier. And she says, my name's Helen, I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, oh my God, like she could be my grandmother. And then she said, my sobriety day was like November 3rd of 1964. And I remember that because I was born in September of 1964. Now that was the first time I'd ever heard the phrase sobriety date. You know, it was not a phrase we used, you know, what guys I drank with, what's your sobriety date tomorrow? But it was, we didn't do that. I knew when she said that she meant she had not had anything to drink almost my entire life, which sounded not only untrue, but not even desirable. And then it went around the room and all these people, you know, like 1972 and blah, blah, blah. And what I remember most distinctly about that meeting was that people talked about how they had felt, but they were talking about it in the past. And what they were describing as their past was very much my present, you know? And I couldn't imagine not being stuck there forever. And people gave me, and these people were saying I didn't have to. And people gave me great suggestions. And they suggested that I should get a sponsor and I should go to meetings and I should pray and I should read the literature and I should start working the steps. But the problem is I have alcoholism and I know you guys need that, but I've already been to a meeting. So I've kind of figured out exactly what I need. And it is slightly less than what you need. And I have insight. It turns out that actually what we think of as insight is actually alcoholism. And we just don't know it. And it seems so right that it's so obvious to me what everybody should do so that the world would work. That is not insight. That is self-centeredness. That is the bondage of self. That's what that looks like. But I didn't know that at the time. So I listened to people very politely and I said, yeah, I am doing none of that except for I read the big book. But other than that, you know, get a sponsor. Like you guys need sponsors. I don't need a sponsor. I was 19 years old when I got sober. And I thought, you older people like 30 and above, basically life is over anyway. So sure, work steps, get a sponsor, go to meetings, whatever you're doing, but I'm going to do what I want to do. People suggested to me, not a step thing, but they suggested to me that I should stay out of relationships for a while, which I knew was just because they were so envious of my freedom because their lives were over. So I did essentially none of what was suggested to me. I went to meetings when I could squeeze them in. Was like a chapter in a Melody Beattie book running from sick relationship to sick relationship. I had developed what I called my switter, which was my sickest woman in the room radar. And it's sort of like, boom, that's me. And of course, if she had Smitter, she came right to me and we was like, and so all these things had the, it felt like, you know, this spiritual connection. It's that illness touching illness. That's all it is. But it was like, oh my, you know, why would God have put her on this bus if we weren't supposed to be together? And that's sort of crazy thinking, but that's what my head does. So I didn't drink and I didn't do anything else. And that would be fine if I didn't have alcoholism. But because I do, things didn't get better. In many ways, they started to get worse. And so I started to get crazier and crazier. I was, I would have like just unbelievable fits of rage. Just like I'm gonna over the top, completely uncontrolled rage. That would alternate nicely with paralyzing depression, you know, unable to get off the couch. I would sit in AA meetings and people would be saying, oh, my life is so good. I'm so glad I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I'm self-centered, like if Dave said, I'm so glad to be sober, look what's happened in my life. I didn't hear Dave saying, I, Dave, have a better life. What it felt like was as though he was standing up, pointing at me and saying, Brian, you don't. That's what it's like to be self-centered. It feels like everything is coming at me. And so I was wildly resentful of all these people around me. And they'd say, I'm happy. I think, well, of course you're happy. If I had your life, I'd be happy too. But I don't have your life. I have my life. And they're telling me, we had your life. And you don't have to have it anymore. But I was resistant. It's like, no. You reason, you know, everybody else gets stuff handed to them. The whole world got the playbook handed to them, except for me. Everybody else gets money handed to them, except for me. Everybody else gets opportunity handed to them, except for me. You know, I'm God's lonely man, I think was the great line. And so, and of course, then I had that feeling my whole life of like, everybody else got the playbook and I didn't get it. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and people say, yeah, here's the playbook. And they hand me the big book. I'm like, I don't want that playbook. I want a different playbook. I want a playbook that doesn't require that I do anything. And that everything good happens. You know, can you give me that one? Doesn't exist. So because of this, and I got more increasingly sick, I finally got to the point, and I think we, you know, Big Book talks about those jumping off points and the you know, the crossroads and those kinds of things. We get to that place if we don't treat the alcoholism, where it seems like the only options are we're going to drink, we're going to throw ourselves into this work, or we're going to kill ourselves. That I couldn't see anything else. And you know, far too many of us choose to drink or kill ourselves. You know, what Bill Wilson described as the supreme, or Dr., I guess it was Dr. Silkworth, described as the supreme sacrifice. And I don't know why I didn't. I mean, I don't know why I didn't get to other places, but what happened to me was I went to a meeting and I was going to share, like really share. I talked at meetings. I didn't share at meetings. I talked at meetings. And I didn't say anything that was really going on inside of me. And so I went to this meeting and it was, you know, like a beginner meeting, say there are 20, 30 people there every week and there's coffee and cake and, you know, cookies, a very nice setup. So I go to the meeting, the coffee's there, the cake, the cookies, not a single other person showed up at the meeting. And I knew they couldn't all be running late because it's like a 7:15 meeting. I showed up at 7:16. So it's not, you know, it's not like they're just in the parking lot. There is nobody there. So I'm ready to leave. And this guy walked in, this guy, Tom F., and he said, where is everybody? And I remember thinking, how would I know? You're the member. Because I was in AA 6, 8 months, something like that. But I didn't think of myself as a member at all. I thought of myself as somebody who was passing through. And he said, why don't we have a meeting ourselves? Which struck me as an absolutely terrible idea. But whatever it would have taken for me to say, why don't you have a meeting yourself? I'll come back later. I was too broken. I didn't have that anymore. And we sat down and he said, what's going on? And it all came out, you know, and all the, like, none of this is working for me. I feel like I jump among, he's like, oh yeah, they're not working. Like, no, I want to drink every day. Like every day I think I want to drink. I want to kill myself. I want to kill that guy. I'd like to get her number. I want to drink. I want to kill myself. You know, it's that sort of like that little dance of those four things. And he's like, oh yeah, the killing yourself. I remember that. And I'm thinking, oh my God, no, you don't. And the answer was, yes, he did. Because he had been right where I was. That guy opened the door to Alcoholics Anonymous for me because he did the opposite of what I would have done in his shoes. Because at that moment in my life, if our roles had been reversed and he had been sitting there and I had been the one who showed up and no one else was there, I would have left. It never would have occurred to me to be of help to him because he was further down the path. He'd done the work. He knew exactly what he had to do. And that's a gift. We can be the doorway for people to AA. We just have to be willing to do it. That God creates that space for us to operate in, and we can be, you know, God with skin, or the, you know, and it's like, where are God's hands? These are God's hands. Everybody has them. Am I going to use them? You know, where's God's mouth? It's right here. Am I willing to use it? And that guy did. That guy was. Sort of funny thing about that story, I ran into him like 16 years later. I was in Mass back in Pittsburgh. He sits down in front of me. Now this guy saved my life. I am ready to relive this great AA moment with him. Not only can he not remember the moment, he has no idea who I am. He cannot remember me at all. And the gift, right? That we should always reach out our hands because we never know who's going to be at the other end. And we never know the powerful opportunity that we are given. If we are willing to participate. That was one of three things that happened like in rapid succession. The second, you know, and I was in this relationship, it fell apart, you know, big surprise. Probably they all had a half-life of about 48 hours. But they were all the right one for at least the first 46. You can do a lot of things in AA you have to go to somebody. I could go. People said stick with the winners. It still wasn't clear to me who the winners were. So I felt pretty terrible about this relationship breaking up. I could have gone to a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but since I wasn't quite in yet, I wasn't drinking, but I didn't really still want to be here. I went to my drug dealer friend who seemed like he should have as much insight on this as any sober member of AA. It's the guy I'm running around with. I'm supposed to be, people are saying, change your people, places and things. And I'm thinking like, I don't really want to be you. I don't mind the not drinking part so much anymore. But I don't want to be sober. You know, I don't want to be one of you. I don't mind not drinking. I don't want to be a guy who doesn't drink. So we're riding around, you know, it was like loaded shotguns in the car all the time. I mean, just sort of crazy. And he pulled a gun on some guy when we were out one night over a parking spot. All the stuff you hear people sharing all the time in AA meetings last night I was with a guy who pulled a gun on somebody over a parking spot. So we sit down and he says, you know, you seem so terrible. I'm gonna do for you what I don't do for other people, which is I'm gonna basically give you free drugs. And he starts doing what he's doing. And I knew it. In that moment, I knew that if I pick this up, everything was coming back. You know, and people had said to me that all this stuff about, you know, like if you play on the tracks, you get hit by the train, and what kills you, the engine or the caboose. I'm thinking, like, why is everybody talking about trains all the time? The first drink gets you drunk, and I'm thinking, like, not where I drink. I knew exactly what they meant at that moment. I knew the drinking was coming back. And I was not going to be able to stop. That was a gift from God. I knew in my bones that I was powerless over alcohol. And the second thing was, sitting there, I knew that despite the first thing, despite knowing it was all coming back, left to my own devices, I was going to do it anyway. And I knew that. And people had said to me over and over, they'd said, there will come a time when no power on earth will keep you sober. And you will either have a relationship with God or you will not. And if you do not, you are done. And that God, as you understand God, can be very different for different people. And it is a wide, wide, as far as I can tell, it's so wide that we can't see the ends of it. But we need to have something. And I knew I didn't have anything. But there's that wonderful promise in the second step that said, God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. I made hard terms, but God didn't. And so sitting there, I closed my eyes and said some version of a prayer that said, if you don't help me, I'm done. And I didn't know what I was praying to or even if there was anything there. And the only way I can describe it is as though something physical happened. It was like something just like was lifted up out of me. The only way I can describe it is like something being pulled right up out of me. And when I opened my eyes, he might have had it, you know, might as well have been a big pile of Arm & Hammer baking soda. I mean, it was just the desire had been lifted. And so I'd like to say, so from there on forward, of course, I've had a perfect faith in God. I heard it better summarized by a woman once who said, I have a deep and abiding faith in God that comes and goes. And I thought that's there I am. There's the courage and the fear and, you know, help me with my unbelief issues. But as long as I stay engaged, that relationship continues to grow. It is the central relationship of my life today. I can say that easily because neither my wife nor my children are on this call. But it is the center. And it is only when I lose sight of that, that life starts to go awry. So I got more involved in the program. I started working with a sponsor, helped me really see like what I had seen in that moment. If I start drinking, I will not be able to stop. Left to my own devices, I will start again, always, was the first step at its essence. And that there was a God, however limited my understanding was, that could restore me to sanity in the sense of, or relieve me of my alcoholism, free me from what I was otherwise doomed to do, which was to keep drinking. Now the question was, would I have that God? And so we knelt down together and said the third step prayer together. If you've never had the opportunity to do it with someone, I can't encourage you enough to do it. I've done it with loads and loads of people, and every time it is a special thing, that special place where we, really the sense that we're doing God's work here. Taking someone's hand to help them to understand that it was already always in God's hand. And they just never knew it, is an incredible gift that we get to give. And give is the wrong way, that we get to participate in. That's the gift. We don't give the gift we give is ourselves. And that is enough. I wrote my first inventory with him. And I did my first fifth step, neither the best fourth or fifth step ever in AA, not the best ones I've ever done. The best I was capable of doing at the time. And that was all that mattered. What matters in those things is that we do it. I I've done a lot of them since then, and each one has its special rewards in it, and I expect that will continue. I started that lifelong process of six and seven, really being willing to be transformed and to participate in that transformation, not to do it myself, but to be opened to be transformed by God. The easiest way I can describe it, though, is I was a sort of reluctant transformant, if that's the right word. The best way I can describe it is you think about the 12 and 12 talks about the seven deadly sins of pride, envy, lust, greed, anger, gluttony, sloth. So approaching those as character defects, I think, all right, envy, don't want that. That's painful. God, you can have that. Gluttony, don't really want that either. That's kind of, I don't want to be a glutton in the sense of I don't want to feel like I'm bloated all the time, I guess, is the best I could think about it. So I don't want that. And sloth, I don't want that because that's going to get in the way of the things I want. I wasn't focused on the prayer saying that this is about becoming of use to other God and other people. I was focused on I want character defects out of my way so that I can do what I want, which is the best I could do initially. And I don't think we get punished for that. I think we get rewarded for that. Because that's the progress. And then eventually what I start to see is that that's still me trying to run my life and it ultimately doesn't work. But I've moved so much closer than I was to letting go of that. So that's three down, right? And so that leaves only pride, greed, lust, and anger. And pride, just pride and greed are sort of the same. I don't want them quite removed. I just want them to be not so obvious. So if you can just sort of sand down the edges of pride and greed, so people don't look at me and say, boy, that guy is super greedy, or that guy's excessively proud, but I have enough left to get what I want. That's good. Anger, same thing. I'm like, I'm a guy who has rage problems, and and they showed up again and later in sobriety. I had terrible rage problems early in sobriety, something we probably don't talk enough about in AA, because I think lots of people have that pop up at different points in sobriety. Early on, everybody says it's fine. When it's 20 years and you're feeling it, it's shameful. And the point is, it's just part of the process. And it's the next level. We need to be open about it. But so I want enough anger that I don't want to be losing my mind and flipping tables. But if I need to flip a table, I want to make sure there's enough anger there. So God, if you can just kind of dial it back a little bit, but leave it there, that'd be good. Don't touch the lust, and I'm ready to go. You know, amen. So there's my prayer, God. That's where the door opened. And God welcomed that. In the end, a lot of that didn't work. And in the end, what those character defects really were, and how much of that really was self-centered living, became so much more clear over time as stuff started to chip away. Because a lot of that is, at least for me, when I was newly sober, I couldn't see this. There's so much chaos, so much obvious unmanageability. It's like the volume of your life is way up. So it's hard to hear anything. But when the volume goes down, suddenly I can start to hear the stuff in the other room. And it's sort of like, oh yeah, that's not working out so well either. I'm not screaming all the time, but now I see this. Oh yeah, you are dishonest in almost every area of your life. You are cheating here. You blah, blah, all those kinds of things. And I could start to see them, and they don't work. And they separate you from God. And that's why I could look at myself and see I was being separated from God. So I was those kinds of things, engaging in those defects, cut me off from the very source of things I needed. I went into the amends process, and I know some people have kind of what I'll call rules about amends of, you have to do this one first, you have to do that one first, you have to have them be ready before you can do any of them. And if those work for people, that's, I would never say not to do it. What I did was as I was ready to make amends, I started to make them. So I had made some amends before I was ready to make others. And I started with low hanging fruit. And that gave me momentum, because when I knocked out the easy ones, so to speak, it felt so good. Now I got moved to, I really want to get all this stuff cleared up. And so I moved from a guy who would walk down the street and just duck around the corner rather than see people, or run into people and just wish the earth would open up and swallow one of us. It can even be me, just to get me out of this conversation, because I had so much shame and guilt and remorse. And I don't have that anymore. There is no one in the world that I can't run into. I'd love to say, and I'm such a God-filled person, that I'm happy to see everybody at the exact same level. That's not true. There are some people in the world I'd rather not run into, not because of anything I'm carrying from the past, just because I don't like them. But I need to stay open to what that brings as well. What I'm describing is kind of a longer process, and that opened up the door for 10, 11, and 12, that kind of ongoing practice of these things, that I'm looking for those things that are dominating my life: fear, dishonesty, selfishness, self-centeredness, all those kinds of things are driving me. And I need to be, the gifts I got in 4 and 5 were the ability to see them and the ability to talk to someone about them. Then the gift I got in 6 and 7 was the ability to be turning to God to be relieved of it. And then 8 and 9 was to see how it harmed other people and try to go into the world living differently. And then carrying that message to people through the practice of 12. So I went back, I ended up sort of jumping back chronologically. I went back to college. I finished college. No one ever thought that was going to happen. And I loved it, and I did well, and everything about it that I had missed before, I got this time. I got very active in AA. I was sponsoring people. I got active in service. I then moved to another part of the world, another part of the country. And they didn't have the AA they had there didn't work the way AA was supposed to work, in my judgment. And in some sense, there was some objective truth to that, in the sense that it was, you could go to a week of meetings and not hear someone talk about the steps. But they would talk about their cats. So it would, so it's a little bit of that mix, but that's not their fault, they're whoever they are. And I remember sitting in meetings and thinking, oh my God, this is terrible. Why isn't anybody talking about the steps? Clear as a bell, a voice said, if you want this meeting to be about the solution, you have to talk about it. It's not what they are talking about in the meeting. It's what I'm not talking about. That's the problem with the meeting. Now I did that inartfully at first. I was much more like a bull in a china shop. And if the traditions had said, you need to have a desire to stop drinking and we need to like you, I would not have been around for very long. But eventually I could carry the message there, and I got better at listening. And the sponsor who told me I needed, now that I had said everything about what AA was, now I needed to listen. I learned from that what a terrible listener I was, that I thought that there were two states. There was talking and listening. That's not true at all. There's talking, not talking, and listening. And I only had talking and not talking. And when I was talking, that's when I was talking. When you were talking, that's when I was not talking and thinking about what I was going to say next, which was why sometimes you weren't finished talking and I started anyway. Because I didn't give any thought to what you were saying. I mean, just to see that self-centered, I just didn't see it. But it was that point where I was so self-centered and so selfish in some ways, that what was going on in my head was far more important to me than what was coming out of your mouth. And I needed to be relieved of that. And I had to pray the same prayer I say for every meeting now, which is that I asked for the ability to carry and receive the message. I have to say that prayer and work things. Can I listen? Because sometimes I don't want to. I finished graduate school, started working. As I've described myself, I was the greatest employee in the history of North America until I started working on a full-time basis. And then all of the opportunities for character defects to manifest themselves in a new environment, they showed up. Alcoholism and that spiritual illness is going to leak out in different ways for people in our life circumstances. We need to be open to that's what's happening, rather than trying to pretend it's not. And it is different for different people. Everybody, I think, well, maybe not everybody, maybe just the most ill among us, but I'll just say everybody fantasizes what they really want is the sort of controlled sex and exercise addiction. So the sex one, where you're sort of meeting interesting people and not, in some phone booth with a cow or something, but an actual cow or whatever actually happens to people who are really ill. And the exercise one, to the point where you're really fit, but you're not, as a friend of mine was, running so much, he was coughing up blood while he was running because his body was breaking down. So I wanted those controlled ones, but that's not what I got. Instead, what I got, my most common one, is work. And my ability to work compulsively is right there with the best of them. And I picked, no surprise, I picked an occupation where I could stop at the end of this meeting and I could work for the next 48 hours and I still would have tons of stuff to do. And there's always something moving. So I got in a place where I was, starting work at 7 o'clock in the morning, getting home at 10:30 at night. That is a long day. I saw it as I was the victim of that. And the truth is, it was an expression of spiritual illness. It was a gift, because it gave me the opportunity to turn back to God. And how do I invite God into my workplace? Because the places I didn't want God were relationships and work. God, I'll have those. Can you take care of everything except my personal relationships and work, and I'll be taking care of those. So of course I'm a workaholic in destructive relationships, big surprise. But bringing God into those places, and that got transformed. I'd had a lot of very ill relationships, as I had said, that changed. God transformed that for me, and transformed me in that space. And so when I was 9 years sober, I got married. My wife and I will this year celebrate our 28th wedding anniversary. Same wife. And I always say this, and I always recognize this is a really low standard. I have never cheated on my wife. I have never hit my wife. I've never come close to doing either. I guarantee you, drunk or dry, I would have done both. No question. Those are ways that my illness would come out. And God relieve me of that. You know, when I was just before my 12th anniversary, our son was born. And I, my anniversary, my wife used to pay a lot more attention to, but my son's birthday is 1 week before my anniversary. So suddenly my anniversary sort of fell off the calendar, which is fine. But all kinds of great stuff came out of that. I never, you know, I was afraid of being a parent in a lot of ways, because I didn't have, I had some good aspects of parental modeling and some bad aspects of it. But you know, in AA, I got, because of what was here, I got to be different than I was, or than I would have been. And part of that, you know, one of the things that came up as a part of being a parent was at some point, it became very clear that one of my amends still felt unmade. When I was newly sober and for a while in AA, people would say to me, you're going to have to make amends to your father. And I had the litany. I would say, are you kidding me? I mean, I remember him like out of nowhere, punching me in the face. I remember him, you know, beating my mother, breaking her arm. And I was the oldest boy. So it was, at least as I saw it, my job to try to stop him. And I remember being small and trying to get in between him and my mother. And I remember like trying to catch him, these big work boots and trying to catch them, you know. And I would think, what would I possibly owe amends for? I didn't do any of that. And I didn't owe amends for any of that. But what I owe amends was for this, that in the midst of all that violence and all that chaos, my father desperately wanted a relationship with his children. And he desperately wanted a relationship where his children loved him and respected him. And I knew that. And so every chance I got, I sent the message that said, I don't love you. And I don't respect you. And I'm ashamed of you. And as soon as I can, I'm going to get out this door and I am never coming back. That's who I was. But how do I make amends for that? Well, I prayed, because if we believe this, that we are getting guided by God, that's what we do. And I kept praying to God about this, about how to be make this amends. And my dad was from Ireland, and there's an Irish game called Irish football. It sort of looks a little like soccer, except you use your hands and a couple other differences. But the Super Bowl of Irish football is called the All Ireland, and it's played every September in Dublin. And my father had grown up kind of dirt poor in Ireland and had always wanted to go to the All Ireland, but had never been able to. And I came out of sleep one morning after I'd been praying for this, and clear as a bell, the voice said, you have to take your father to the All Ireland. And I thought, that's a terrible idea, you know? But I either have made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God and sought conscious contact with God, or I haven't. And if I have, then I do it and follow it. And if I haven't, then I should shut up and stop pretending I have. Now, I'm imperfect. So I called my younger brother, whom God had not mentioned. And I said, we have to take our father to the All-Ireland. And he said to me what I already knew. He said, look, it's tough to get tickets in Ireland. It's going to be impossible for us to get tickets here. I said, I'm telling you, I know that, but we've got to try. So I'm running every lead I can. He's doing everything. Like 3 weeks later, my brother calls me. He says, you're not going to believe this. He says, I know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy who works for an ad agency in Dublin. And he has tickets to the All Ireland and he'll sell them to us. So I have to supply the willingness. God gave me the tickets. God gave me the money. So this was in June probably. And buying tickets in June for the All-Ireland is like buying tickets to the Super Bowl in October. You know where it's going to be played. You know when it's going to be played. You just don't know who's going to be in it. And I used to be able to joke that you know it's not going to be Cleveland, but that's no longer true. Now even they're going to be in it. So who knows what they're doing? You don't know anything anymore. But it was So we had to go, and we went that year. And my brother and I and father, we flew to Ireland, spent the weekend there, went to the game, and we flew back. And that year, the county my father grew up in played in the All-Ireland. And he, that weekend, opened up and talked about things that had happened in his life that he had never told anyone with me, you know. And we get that chance that in amends, not only do we get free, we can, if we participate, we create space in which other people can get free, freedom that other people might have no other way to get to. And God gives us that chance. And, you know, from that time until the time my father got really ill, he talked about that weekend all the time. It's the greatest weekend of his life. And I, and people would come up to me and say, your dad always talks about how you took him to the All-Ireland. You know, when he died, he got very ill, and I was actually able to be with him through the whole thing, and actually a net positive, because I would have been a net negative. And when he died, everything was clear. You know, I was sad, but that was it. I wasn't carrying the past anymore, because I could see my dad, all that stuff, all the narrative I ran about all the stuff that happened. That's what the big book talks about. That someone who is spiritually sick, and even though we don't like how it manifests itself, that's someone who is suffering. And I could see him as someone who had suffered. And he just suffered differently than I did. And I kind of did similar stuff with my mom in terms of clearing that. And when she died about 2 years ago, and again, same thing, got to be able to be there for that. But because those things were different, because I was free of that, and no longer carrying the weight of that, I got to be a different parent. And at one point, the rage started to come back. My son would start to do stuff, and suddenly I would be sitting there like perfectly happy, and something would come to my head, you ought to knock his teeth out. He'd learn. And he wasn't really doing much at all, really, wasn't that. Of course, I'm a long time sober. Do I want to say anything about this to anybody? No. So I call people, talking to people, and praying about what to do. And I was talking to my sponsor, and he said, I really think you should go to Al-Anon and get some kind of therapy. I think you would be really helpful. You haven't done that for a while. And I was embarrassed, you know, for him, that he could be so off. The next day I was talking to my longest time friend in the fellowship. And he said, you know, look, I love you. And, you know, we've been friends for a long time. You really should go to therapy. And have you thought about going to Al-Anon? This is not Al-Anon. Those things transformed it. And so I did not have to suffer the way my father had to suffer in terms of how he treated his children, which meant that my kids didn't have to suffer the way we suffered. My son developed alcoholism, you know, and I could see it. And I've been so scared of what happened, because it's so common in my family. And I was praying it wouldn't happen. I tried to parent him out of alcoholism. By the way, total failure. Don't try that. It doesn't work. It's like saying, I'm going to parent you out of cancer. It's an illness. You either have it or you don't. But when it happened and he was really in it, I was praying to God. And what I was saying was, how could you do this? You know, I've tried to do everything you asked that I could hear, at least. How could you do this? And the answer I got was, who better to parent someone with alcoholism than someone who's recovered from it? Why would I think it would be someone else? And so I got to be a different parent with him. You know, and when he called me to say, I think I need to go to rehab, I could be there. You know? Through the grace of God, he's sober 4.5 years now, doing really well. And it rocketed our relationship to a next level. I have another child as well. Who's 14, a daughter. My wife would say that if you look at our daughter very carefully, you'll see her little finger sags. And it's because daddy's wrapped all the way around it. You know, it's been a gift, and my son is our biological child. My daughter was born in Guatemala, was adopted, and people would always say, "It's so nice of you to do that, to adopt somebody." And I recognized, well, I mean, I understood what people were saying, but it's not that way at all. It's the opposite. That it was this unbelievable gift to get to parent her. And there are days she pushes, it makes it hard to memorize that because she's 14. But you know, we get to be there. It's this unbelievable gift. And, you know, I've had the chance to work with and sponsor a lot of people, and I've sponsored people who have done, you know, really transformed lives, and people who aren't with us anymore. You know, helped people through the same kinds of amends, that the gift of going through that stuff, like with my family, with my father, because I sponsored a lot of guys who had really difficult relationships with their fathers, finding their way to amends with that and getting that kind of freedom. That in that third step prayer, we ask for victory over our difficulties that we may bear witness. That's how we bear witness, by staying involved with that. So I will end now, because I think I'm right up on the, well, right up as in over the time. That's the alcoholic way of being right on time, which is over time. And I'll just end with a story. It happened years ago, but it's always for me been this sort of like perfect little AA synopsis. It's just sort of summary story is this a woman I knew was really struggling. And she went to an anniversary meeting, and there was, you know, cake and cookies and families, an open anniversary meeting. And but she was struggling, and she has alcoholism. So she had the opportunity to talk to lots of people or go in the corner by herself and cry. And I'll give you one guess, which she picked, crying corner. So she's sort of off by herself in a corner. And this little girl came over to her and said, "Why are you crying?" And my friend said, "Basically, it's grown-up stuff." And the little girl said, "You don't have to cry here." She said, "This is a good place. They took my daddy and they made him better." And you know, that's exactly what AA did to me. It took me and it made me better. And that is a gift that is available to anybody who is willing to accept it. So Dave, thank you so much for asking me, and thank you all for listening.
Oh, Brian, thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm going to allow everyone to unmute and I'll try to recover from the puddle that I'm in. Thank you so much.
Everybody, thank you so much. So helpful.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you,
Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Wonderful night. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Good to be here.
Thank you, sir. That was fantastic. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. I'm going to take the meeting back. We'll give Brian a chance to exhale and we'll do a little business here. Let's see. Please, you see the note from Larry. Please send your questions in. I'll put a link in the chat. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Send in your questions. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements for the good of AA tonight? You can unmute yourself. Anybody? What are we doing? We got a supper and a speaker coming up. Anybody got the date on that? All right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, We will be available here after we close this meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All righty, let's see where the questions are. Not too many. You guys can do better. Brian, that was amazing. That was just wonderful. I am also a bull in a china shop, burdened with the gift of insight. and I'd never heard that so clearly tied to selfishness and self-centeredness. Thank you for that. I love the deep and abiding faith that comes and goes. And you made a bunch of references to kind of normalizing some of this stuff. Like you used the example of finding yourself 20 years sober and coming up, you know, with a rage and then not feeling comfortable to talk about it. I just have a sense that there's these are important points. And I wonder if there's any more in there you'd like to share.
Well, we're talking about me, so I could go on all night. I think we were talking in the fourth step about getting to principles, and I didn't get that quite at first, but eventually I could kind of first level, I could see it things like honesty as a principle, and kind of I didn't like honesty because I didn't like to have to be honest, because I wanted the truth to be different than it was. But then there are those next layer ones, which are the things that are driving me, and that one of the common ones, of course, for me is I don't want people to see who I really am. There's that part of me that never wanted people to see who I really was, and I wanted to sort of control the image, basically, and have you think who I am. I think that went down substantially in AA, and that's one of the gifts of the seventh step of sponsorship, and that it really seeing that all of me is there, but it still comes up at some points. Like no one, maybe there is someone, I don't know, I shouldn't say no one. I can say this person, when I'm 20 years sober and suddenly having a fit of rage, like I'm perfectly fine and just pointing up, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be. And the problem with alcoholism, at least, is sometimes it's, I don't want to be that guy, and therefore I'm not. And so now, since I'm not that guy, that can't be happening. So it sort of wants to get repackaged. And the answer is, I don't want to be that guy, but I am exactly that guy. And seeing it as, that's actually a gift, because it is one of those places that drives me back to God. That it is my only shot. There's no other way to get there. I'm really relieved of that, other than in my relationship with God and being open to where that guidance is. So those kinds of things that I actually want to hide, the truth is, if I can pull them out in the light, it's not so much that the light destroys them, so to speak, or transforms them. That's certainly part of it. But what it really is when I pull it out in the light, I see what it is. And I can see how powerless I am over it. And I can see that there's parts I'm holding on to and parts I haven't let go of. And I need to be making sure that I'm stepping back to create the space for God, that God should be filling there, not Brian. Hopefully that made as much sense outside of my head as it made in. But
perfect. Thank you. We have someone here saying, can you offer some suggestions about the fourth step? I'm all over the place with lists of bad stuff I did, lists of name defects in my part. And it just says help. sounds like they're in the middle of a fourth step, kind of drowning a little bit.
Absolutely. So first thing is, my number is on there, and whoever said that, if you want to either call me or text me after this, I'd be happy to help in any way I can. If you call me, be sure to leave a message, because I get so many spam calls, I don't answer numbers I don't recognize. So, but if you text me or call me, I'm happy to talk to you. It's just as a starting place. It is easy in the fourth step, I think, to lose sight of what's happening there and to get kind of bogged down by it. If I think about the fourth step as starting in the third step, what's my problem? It is selfishness and self-centeredness, all those manifestations of self that I need to be relieved of. And some of it is the, what I'll call the seeming almost the moral stuff, selfishness, like I'm grabbing, whatever that looks like. But then there's also self-centeredness, which is to me more like nearsightedness. It is, it's neither immoral, it's more, it's neutral. It's just how the world looks to me. I seem to be at the center of it. So everything is touching me. And I need to be relieved of that. And that's what I've done. So the fourth step then starts with those common manifestations of self. That's what I was talking about. The resentments, the fear, and the sex relationship inventory. But so starting with, you were talking about the list. That most important part about the resentment list for me is, like a lot of people, I was very good on columns 1 and 2. Joe did this. I was actually pretty good on column 3 as well. Joe did this and it hurt me. Column 3.5, which is the prayer problem, the prayer portion, where I now go back over that to look at it in a different place and see Joe as spiritually ill. And I'm asking that my relationship to Joe can be transformed. And then column 4, that's the real gift in the fourth step. And column 4, I think sometimes we do use that real shorthand of what's my part in it. And that's not a bad shorthand, except it can be misleading. Because I would think of what's my part in it as, okay, Joe did this, I did that, you know, so I hit Joe hit me, but I only hit Joe after he did this. And he looked at my girlfriend, you know, whatever it is, and it becomes this kind of confusing thing. And that's actually not what the fourth column is about at all. It really is that, you know, where was I selfish? Where was I self-seeking? Where was I dishonest? Where was I frightened? And so the example of my father, that stuff, you know, the physical stuff that went on with us, I didn't do anything to cause that. I mean, I really didn't. And that was all I could see. So when I said, what's my part in it? This is my father. He hit me. I felt bad. I didn't do anything to cause that. The resentment, though, was that because I hung on to it for so long, and I was dishonest about some of it, in that all I would ever focus on is the bad stuff my father did. My father was an incredibly hardworking guy who came from not a lot of anything, and got to wherever he got to through a lot of hard work and determination, who in his own way really loved his family. I couldn't see any of that. And I lied about it even to myself. And I also, I perpetuated it, because now poor Brian, why isn't Brian succeeding? Well, we'll look at Brian's dad. Look what Brian's dad did. Because I was so afraid of things that I was just as happy to fail if I could blame you. I was maybe even happier to fail blaming you than I was to succeed. Because if I succeeded, I was kind of vulnerable. I could then fall. But if I failed and it was your fault, that seemed okay to me. So a lot of that came out in the fourth step and the resentment piece. The fear, kind of the same thing. It's the really seeing that it's driving how I'm living. It is actually reshaping my life. It is as though I'm carrying a big bag, 80-pound bag of fear on me all the time, and it's causing me to stoop. It's changing how I hit the world. Resentments do the same thing. And I need to be free of that so I can come in. And then the sex relationship inventory, of course, kind of the same stuff. How am I behaving in those relationships? It asks that question, like, you know, do we inspire jealousy? Yeah, I did it all the time. Unjustifiably arise jealousy or suspicion. Yes, I did it all the time. Why? Because I was so afraid that if people saw me, they would run away from me. So it was always about keeping everything off balance. And I had one foot out the door all the time. Because I couldn't stand the intimacy of actually being emotionally present for people I wasn't capable of. So that's probably a much longer answer than you were hoping for. And that might cause you never to want to call me, but I'd be happy to help in any way.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I too struggle with anger and sobriety. Can you share some more of your experience of how Al-Anon and therapy helped with that?
Sure. The thing I, so around families, kind of an easy example is a lot of what was happening for me and the anger, some of it was
stuff that was actually kind of therapy stuff. It was just the scars that come from growing up the way we grew up, and getting through the therapy piece of that was incredibly helpful. And the amends with my father, I mean, all that whole process gave me a lot of freedom from that. One of the things that was really helpful to me is that it Al-Anon shone a new light for me on my problem of selfishness and self-centeredness. And so, for example, my kids, my son particularly was older, I would get angry at him because he wasn't doing the right thing. I don't mean he was stealing. I mean, he was not finishing his homework on time or something like that. And I would always say, I can't stand to see my children struggle. And it turned out that was an incomplete sentence. The real sentence was, I can't stand to watch my children struggle because I can't stand how it makes me feel. It was about me. And I realized if I felt differently about what they were doing, I would be behaving differently. So if my children were struggling and I was looking at it and saying, oh, thank God, they're going to struggle and this is how they get to the other side, I would behave completely differently. So what they were doing actually had very little to do with what I was doing, was driven by my fear and my self-centeredness. And then it was applying the same principles of the underlying principles of the steps, the same turning to God in those places. One of the places I didn't really want to let go is with my children. Because what if God has a different plan for them than the one I do? What if it's a lesser plan? What if, God forbid, God wants them to have alcoholism? I can't stand that. So that fear was driving it, and nothing good comes from a life driven by fear.
I love this question. How can I learn to tell on myself? I say I'm all right when I'm really not. How can I break that habit?
So a great one. When I was newly sober, certainly, and that didn't go away not being newly sober, but it was so evident to people when I was newly sober. And there was this old guy, I say old, he was probably like my age now, but basically to me at the time, you know, I was 19, so he seemed like Methuselah. And I remember talking to him after a meeting once, and he asked me how I was doing. I was just, I'm fine. And he said, you know, you should always keep coming back because you can always be an example, even if it's a bad one. And I was like, is he talking to me? And the answer was, yes, he was talking to me. But what he was telling me was, as if I kept coming, and I could see it all ultimately, if I kept coming, people would learn from me. And eventually the flip side of that is maybe I would learn from them. And one of the things I learned to do was to open up to people. Sponsorship was invaluable for that, no question. But I had to find a sponsor that I wanted to connect with. A lot of times what we do is we find someone we don't really want to connect with, or we find someone who's not available. Either they're like literally not available, we have conflicting schedules or something like that, or they're not emotionally available. And then I don't have to connect with them. If I'm not connecting with my sponsor and I'm doing everything I can to do that, then it doesn't mean there's something wrong with the sponsor, but there is something wrong with the relationship. And it might be that I need to find somebody else. I talk to somebody in AA every single day. I never let a day go by without talking to somebody in AA. And that gives me the gift of that kind of reporting, so to speak, about what's going on. And ultimately in that 10th step process, when we're asking, you know, where am I frightened, resentful, dishonest, selfish, and I'm asking, and the process in the 10th step is we ask for that. We see if somebody's harmed, we share it with somebody else. If we need to make amends, we do that. But we tell somebody about it immediately, and then we turn to God, and then we turn to how can we help other people. So the more I practiced it, the better I got, because it was so scary for me to do that, which is silly. I mean, people call me, there's nothing people can't tell me now, but I suspect they have the exact same feeling I had, which is like, I don't want to tell you, oh my, you know, I stole money from my kids to drink. Okay, I have good news for you. The reason you can say I stole money from my kids to drink, and that's a sentence that makes sense in English, is because thousands of people have done it before you and they can get free of it the same way you can.
Thank you. Someone wants to know, how has service played a role in your recovery?
So I have done what I call like formal service, you know, intergroup and GSR, and I was the intergroup chair and all kinds of things like that. And that has been very helpful for me. There is no question though that for me, individual one-on-one or working in small groups with people to kind of get through the steps or dive deeper into the literature, that has made a bigger difference. I think it seems that that's where I'm more effective. I was the chair of intergroup. I don't know that I was a particularly good intergroup chair. I did achieve the one thing, which was the very first meeting I went to was a 2-hour meeting. I said, I'm just going to listen because I don't really know what's going on here. It was a 2-hour meeting. I said, well, okay, my short-term agenda here is these meetings aren't going on for 2 hours anymore. And so, and actually it turned out the solution to that was, we had people who liked to complain every meeting. And this became the phrase, which is, I'm glad you raised that. That is really good. What I'd like to do is I'd like to appoint you as the chair of a small subcommittee. And if you can get a few people together and you guys can work together and come back and talk about how we can fix that, that would be great. It separates the wheat from the chaff in the sense you really get to what's really a problem and what's just somebody else complaining. But for me, it's really one-on-one and in those small groups, right in the literature and on the steps.
Right on. How did the pandemic affect your sobriety? Any lessons or changes that you made that you'd like to share?
So I don't know if you've heard of Zoom meetings, but I had to go to those during the pandemic. when it first happened, two things. First off, I had a surprising to me how visceral reaction I had of how I didn't want to do Zoom meetings. It didn't seem like real AA. That was my silly reaction. And since we were only going to be out for 2 weeks, and I actually had scheduled to meet with somebody I sponsored almost every one of those 14 days, why did I have to worry about this? So that was like the first 5 days of the pandemic. And I thought, all right, you can't really do that. you're clearly something's here and you need to work. So, I've gone on 12 step calls during the pandemic, and that didn't change. I think that it's, there were aspects of it that were incredibly valuable to me. Honestly, in terms of exposure to perhaps people or groups that I never would have been able to get to in the kind of non-Zoom world. So that was very good. I absolutely missed the in-person aspects of things but I upped my probably number of meetings I would go to in a week. That definitely went up because of Zoom. And I recognize that I should disclose that is the, I was very fortunate through the whole pandemic. Everybody in my family stayed healthy. I have a job that I can do remotely. My kids were generally able to do school remotely. I could go to meetings remotely. So I didn't have a job that I either lost or had to go into and put myself at risk all the time. I didn't have family members who were dying from this. I didn't have a home life situation that made it incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to go to Zoom meetings. And lots of people had all of those. So I was fortunate in that. I think that one of the things this really did also was, I don't know that I've ever strayed very far from the literature, but this really drove me back into it in lots of good ways. And so we have a group of us who are slowly but surely working our way through Living Sober. It's actually taking us longer to walk through it than it took them to write it, but it's been great. And so I think all of those things, if that makes sense.
Wonderful. we're out of time, but I'm going to tap you for one more, given that you've been around for so long. Do you identify like anything in the old days of AA, or how has AA changed for the worse or the better? Is there anything you miss about the AA you walked into compared to today? I don't know if there's anything in there.
So a great question. And at one point I would have like absolutely told you all the ways that AA had worsened. But here's the funny thing about it is I was so ill when I walked into AA that I wouldn't have asked me for a zip code, much mind for an accurate representation of what was actually happening in AA. So what really happened is when I walked into AA, the AA that I needed was there. And my job is to make sure that when somebody walks in now, the AA they need is here. You know, when my son walked in, the AA he needed was here. And I think that we've gotten a lot better in some things. I think that there's been a real uptick, I think, in people talking about and really focusing on the big book, which I think has been a good thing. A lot of that, I think there's probably stuff that culturally has happened that has come into AA and helped us to make sure that everybody who comes through the door who has alcoholism feels welcome. That if you're coming in the door and you are fill in the blank, you are gay, you are a different race than the people in the room, any of those kinds of things, I think we are better. I think we were good when I got here. People were going to, and I think we're better, and I think we're going to get even better. Because I think as long as we're staying and trying to do God's work, I think God's keeping that door open for everyone.
Ah, thank you. Just wonderful. That is going to bring us to a close. Everybody will get the opportunity to thank Brian after we pray. Let's see, where am I in this script? Like to thank everyone who participated, Brian, Larry, for wrangling the questions. Real quick, somebody chatted me directly. All of our recordings can be found on the simpleactions.net website, simpleactions.net. All the past speakers are recorded and posted there. Maybe not the last couple of weeks, but the last couple of years anyway. But we do not have a list of the speakers who are speaking in the future. You're just going to have to show up to get that. So thanks for everybody. And I wonder if our dear Debbie would read a vision for you.
Sure. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Debbie. And Debbie. This comes from the big book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
All right. Thank you. How about we all virtually circle up? And feel free to unmute, and let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be
thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. On earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and glory, forever and ever. Amen. Amen. Woohoo! Thank you, Brian. That was awesome.
Thank you so much,
Brian. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good talk.
Thank you, Brian.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, you're being patient in affliction back there, Karen.
The dad story. The dad.